Nexus in Exile. It's our season theme, and here we are again, back in exile, strictly online, but it's great to be able to connect with some of you who've been tuning in online while we've been out at the farm. But here we are, my goodness, it's 38 weeks into the pandemic, and today also marks the beginning of Advent, and Advent I'm sure to be like no other. And you know, ever since the pandemic, I've been thinking a lot about this idea of exile. And it seemed to me appropriate to make this a sort of specific Advent series talking about life in exile. It fits well, I think, with the times that we are living in. And you know, to be in exile simply means this, be it physically or spiritually or emotionally, to be in exile is this sense of feeling displaced or not being at home or not being where you want to be. And that feeling of being in exile can leave us in some challenging circumstances. How do you live in exile? How do you face the unique challenges that life in exile brings? And, you know, these are questions that I want to explore throughout the course of this series. And I want to do that by simply highlighting stories of exile from Scripture. You see, one of the most important themes in all of Scripture is this idea of exile. The Bible is a story, you could say, a big story of exile and trying to find home again. It can't be overstated how important the idea of exile is to understanding Scripture. And it starts right at the very beginning, right? Adam and Eve are the first archetypal humans. They are ejected, they are displaced from Eden. And from that point on, the story of Scripture is that something has gone awry for humanity. Humanity's never really been at home since, but then this idea of exile becomes attached to a particular family and people and place. It starts with the Hebrew people, because of famine, having to leave their home, and they head down to Egypt. They end up enslaved there for 400 years, four centuries. They are stuck in Egypt as exiles. And then there's a later exile, of course, where they're in Babylon, carted off to Babylon. And even as the pages of the New Testament open, what we find there is the people, they're in their home, these Hebrew people, but they're occupied by a foreign power. And so they're in exile, you could say, at home. Not so different from us, I suppose, but they're in exile at home. And even as we make our way into the beginning of the church epistles of the New Testament, right? Paul and Peter, they pick up on this idea of exile. In fact, Peter calls those who follow the Christian path, he calls us foreigners and exiles, because his idea, of course, is that we are living in a world that is so often run by greed and violence in the way of power and control and manipulation. And you know, for Peter, it's this sense that we can never truly feel at home as long as our world is sort of run that way. So we are exiles and foreigners here. And so for this Advent season, what I want to do is I just want to highlight, showcase stories from Scripture about life in exile and allow those stories to inform us or speak to us, engage us in dialogue, you could say, about how we can live in exile during these times. And I want to start with the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And if you grew up in Sunday school, chances are you heard it there, probably on flannel graph or something, but this is a classic Sunday school story. It's got all the Hollywood markings of a great epic story, right? But when I returned to this story this year, I was absolutely shocked. It suddenly felt to me very urgent and prophetic and controversial, to be honest. And suddenly this familiar story, it was speaking to me about all sorts of things like COVID and politics and flags and symbols and national anthems and what it means to do civil disobedience. And so I want to dive into this story as a life in exile story. And to do that, I first need to unpack how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how they end up in that place. The pinnacle, of course, of the Hebrew people's story is when King David arrives on the scene and he sets up Israel's kingdom in Jerusalem, and it comes to be known as Zion, the city of peace. And then David's son Solomon builds this majestic, glorious temple to the God of the Hebrew people's ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And for 400 years, this temple stands. This is when the people are at their sort of heyday, you could say. For four centuries, the temple stood there gloriously in Jerusalem. But in the 7th century BC, more than 1,000 miles away to the west, there's an empire on the rise, the empire of Babylon and its king, Nebuchadnezzar. He's a very ambitious man, and he starts taking over everything around him. He expands his kingdom 1,000 miles to the west, and eventually he just annexes Jerusalem. It was no real challenge, of course. I mean, Babylon was this mighty empire that just sort of marched in and did that. Israel was a tiny, like, city-state compared to Babylon's massive empire. And so in 605, Nebuchadnezzar, he flexes his muscles. He decides he's going to deport the king of Judah and many of the elite from within Israel off to Babylon. And so he sort of takes away, you could say, the upper echelon, the upper society of Israel, the well-to-do and the educated people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're all taken to Babylon. And with their education, of course, these are the people Babylon thinks can serve the kingdom well. So he takes the best people, so to speak, and in their place, he sets up this puppet kingdom, this puppet king, King Zedekiah. And eventually, this puppet kingdom is happening, but eventually King Zedekiah, he's got glory in his mind. He sort of thinks to himself, wait a second here, we are the people of God. God is surely on our side. We don't need to take this anymore. We can fight back against Babylon. And so they decide they're going to rebel. And they take on the Babylonians, and they get absolutely crushed. Like, total devastation. You know, I was with Huxley, and we were looking in a little library, and Huxley decided he wanted to get a book from this little library around town, and he picked out this book. It's called, I don't know if you can see that, Castle Challenge, and it looked fun enough to me, although the cover of the castle's on fire. So we get to reading it, and it's a children's book, I presume. And what this book does is it describes how to perform siege warfare. And as we've gotten into it, I'm like, this is bizarre for a kid's book. What it details is all the different strategies to take on a walled city or a fortress or castle. And it details all these things like poison the city's water supplies or the castle's water supplies. Here's the weapons you need to eventually break them down after you've starved the people inside the city gates. I'm like, I don't know if this was a great little library pick or who put this in a little library, but it's a little weird. It details siege warfare. And this is precisely what King Nebuchadnezzar does. He sets up a siege warfare around Jerusalem that lasts a year. For a year, he employs all these tactics in the book. He sort of starves them out, weakens them slowly, slowly over time. And then finally, he invades the city and past the walls of Jerusalem. It's just devastation. But the worst part for the Hebrew people is they didn't just invade and take over the city. They destroyed the temple. For 400 years, this had been a sign to them of God's dwelling place with them, God being with them, and the Babylonians level it. And then these poor people are carted off to Babylon with what they can carry on their back. I mean, the only real equivalent we have of something like this over, say, the past 500 years is the black populations from Africa who were stolen and carted off to Europe or North America. Or I think about the experience of our indigenous populations here who, when, you know, settlers arrived, their land was either stolen from them, they were killed, taken for, essentially cultural genocide took place. We took their kids, carted them off to residential schools. I mean, this is a thing that very few of us can get our heads around, how this sort of idea of being stolen from your home and carted off somewhere, how that plays out. It's the same for the Hebrew people. They arrive in Babylon, and looking to the west, they realize, like, they're more than a month's walk away from Jerusalem and home. And they don't speak the language, and they have no idea what's going on. They're totally confused. They thought God was with them, and God seems to have abandoned them. They can't make sense of what's happening theologically. And it's taking all of their energy to just sort of survive in those initial early days. And so the pressing question for these exiles becomes, well, what do you do? How do you live in exile? And in the beginning, they sort of huddled together, right, with their neighbors and friends, the ones who speak their language. And in their disoriented confusion, they begin to whisper and hear news and gossip about sort of the things that they're hearing. And some voices come along and they start saying things like, listen, don't worry, everyone. This won't last long. Like, maybe we're here for a few weeks, maybe a few months. I mean, at most a year, but this is not going to last long, and then we can go home. And so there's this sort of hope for them that this is a very short and temporary experience. But then a letter from the prophet Jeremiah arrives to these Hebrew exiles, and he writes to them in Babylon, and his letter essentially sort of reads this way. Exiles, I hate to say it, but I've got some bad news for you. Your exile, it's not going to be a few weeks or months or a year. It's going to last generations. Generations you're going to be here. In fact, many of you, you're going to die without ever seeing home again. Whatever hope these people had with Jeremiah's letter, it's just squashed. But Jeremiah, of course, doesn't want to leave them in total and utter despair. And so he writes a sort of, hey, here's what you do then. And you're going to be there for a long while. So this is how you live in exile. And this is what he says in Jeremiah 29. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. I mean, the message is this. You've got to get on with your lives. You got to make a home there. You got to settle in and make the best of it. Build houses, plant fruit, have kids, get a job, settle in. Do the best you can for the general welfare of the city of Babylon, because this is where you're going to live for generations. And so it's a strong message, because it's like, don't try to revolt. We tried the war and violence game. It doesn't work. We got crushed. Don't try to wage war. That's not my way, God says. Just settle in. Make what you can of a bad situation, which is a decent lesson for us as well. I think many of us are facing a Christmas here like no other. And it's like, oh, the weight of that can drain us down. But Jeremiah's words here for those in exile is, you got to make the best of a bad situation. You got to just settle in and make the most of it. And this is what the people there do. They take his words to heart. They settle in. And over the years, they get jobs, build houses, have kids. But after some time there, a new danger arrives. You see, as kids are born and the next generation begins to come along, well, these kids are born in Babylon. And sure, they hear stories from their parents and grandparents about home, about Zion, about this great city to the west. But for them, they've never seen this mythical land. They've never been there. Their eyes have never seen it. And so for the exiles, their worry now isn't just about, hey, how long are we going to be here? Or it's not about settling in. The worry becomes, we're going to assimilate too much. They're worried that they're going to sort of lose their specific cultural identity, their distinctive faith, their way of life. The danger is that they might lose their identity altogether and simply assimilate and become Babylonians. And so for these exiles, this is their pressing question. How do you navigate your way between violent revolution and fighting for freedom and simply giving up and becoming Babylonian? How do you navigate seeking the welfare and the best for the city of Babylon while not also losing your cultural identity and faith? Like, how do you thread the needle between the two? And this is where the book of Daniel comes in, because it's a book that essentially tries to address these difficult questions. How do you live in exile? And this brings us back, of course, to the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Notice, by the way, this is interesting. Their names have been changed. Those were not their Hebrew names. Their names have been changed in Babylon to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's important to notice that because when they arrive in Babylon, they're renamed. What Babylon is doing is essentially cultural genocide. We want to take away your history, your name, any memory you have of home. Forget your identity. Forget your name. You're no longer that. You're Babylonian now. And so those names are key to me. But what this book and these guys are trying to do is thread this needle. How do we seek the best for the city while also remaining ourselves, staying true to our identity? And this is how their story plays out. These guys were some of the first people carted off to Babylon because they were the highly educated ones. And so when they arrived in Babylon, they were trained and given government positions. They were higher up in the social strata of things. And of course, it isn't long before trouble comes. And this is how the story plays out in Daniel chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So, the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you're commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Now let's unpack what's going on in this story, because I think the parallels to our time can get lost in sort of the language of the story. But what Nebuchadnezzar does, he set up an idol, an image, a visible effigy, you could say, of the Babylonian dream. It's a symbol of Babylon and all that Babylon stands for. Our equivalent today would probably be, I don't know, say a flag. A visible symbol meant to capture the idea and dream behind Babylon's aspirations and values. And while an idol or a flag to us might technically mean nothing, it contains power because it holds within it sort of the idea behind something. There's a power in symbols that can be very dangerous. I mean, think about it this way, a little imagination exercise for us. Bring to mind your favorite flag, whatever flag is the most meaningful, you could say, to you. So for some of us, it might be the Canadian flag, or for others, it might be the rainbow flag, or for others, it might, you know, it might even be your favorite sports team flag, who knows, whatever it is. Now imagine I told you that this week I decided I needed to clean my toilet. It was very dirty. So what I did is I grabbed an old flag, whatever your favorite one is, I grabbed this old flag, I cut it up into rags, and then I scrubbed my toilet clean with that flag. Now, how would you respond to that? I mean, my guess is that many of us couldn't explain why, but we'd be troubled by me using a flag to clean my toilet. I mean, because here's the thing. On the one hand, we know, right, that a flag is, it's nothing. It's a piece of material. It's just a piece of cloth, but it's also more than that, right? It means more to us. Flags, symbols, idols, they're all sort of the same. They carry the power of an idea behind them. And this is what's going on in this story. You see, Nebuchadnezzar has just made an image, of course, but it's more than an image. This image carried with it, you could say, the Babylonian dream, the dream and vision behind Babylon itself as an empire. And so what Nebuchadnezzar does is he crafts this idol, this symbol or flag, you could say, and then he has his favorite band play the Babylonian national anthem. And his expectation is this: when you see the symbol of Babylon, the flag of Babylon, and you hear the Babylonian national anthem, you're to bow down and worship it. Now, I really hope you're starting to see the parallels with our own time, because the reality is we do something very similar in our world. Take a sports game. Before the game can begin, our attention is drawn to what? Our national symbol, our national flag. And then we hear the national anthem. And what's the expectation of us? Stand up, remove your hat, pay homage. The idea is we must respect the idea, the driving vision behind our country. It's not hard to see parallels to today, is it? When our national anthem plays, everyone's got to stand up, take off their hat, give homage to our flag, the symbol of our state, the idea of our country captured in a symbol. But in this story, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they won't do it. They won't give their allegiance to a flag or the national symbol of Babylon. But why? Well, remember, they were taking Jeremiah's advice. They were working for the government. They were doing all they could to help Babylon flourish. This wasn't for them about revolution or violence or overthrowing the system or government. I mean, this was a sort of peaceful protest, you could say. They were more than happy to work for the welfare of Babylon, but they had convictions that they couldn't compromise. They would not bow down to an idol or stand at attention to an idol that symbolized a state that was founded on greed, slavery, war, violence, genocide. And so for them, it's like, nope, we'll do our best for the peace and prosperity of the city, but pay homage, give allegiance to a nation founded on stolen land and people carted off from their homes. No, we can't go there. And I hope things are starting to feel close to home for us here. Because what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego know is this: when you live in a nation, it can become an idol. And well, you can't bow down to that. Because when you do, you start to lose your identity. You lose your identity, you lose your calling to be a citizen of a different kingdom. Brian Zahn says this: nationalism is a religion, and as a Christian, I'm obligated to call it idolatry. For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refused to give allegiance or pay homage to a symbol of a state that was founded on greed, slavery, war, violence, genocide. Now, sure, I suppose you could say, this is an ancient story with no meaning for us today. But I wonder, might we have stories akin to this today? I mean, what happens when people won't pay homage to a national symbol and a national anthem? If only we could think of a contemporary example. All right, this guy, Colin Kaepernick. What happened to him? He got into a whole lot of trouble, right? And I mean, ask yourself this the next time, should we ever get to do these sorts of things again, but ask yourself this, the next time you're at the Kitchener Rangers game or the next time you go to the Toronto Blue Jays game, what would happen if when the Canadian flag is sort of brought out on display and the national anthem plays and we're told to stand and take our hats off, what would happen to you if you refused to? I mean, the parallels are hard to ignore here. I mean, how was our country founded? Through peace and harmony? Or greed and violence and genocide? I mean, my guess is this, not standing for our national anthem, well, at best, it would feel, I think, pretty awkward for us. At worst, I get the sense some people around us might not be too happy. And acts like these can leave you in a whole lot of trouble when we refuse to pay homage to a symbol. And the same thing plays out for these three characters, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They end up in a lot of hot water here. I mean, they were willing to do their part for Babylon, for its welfare, but give homage or pay allegiance to a city founded on things that are against the nature of God? No, they wouldn't do that. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar is not happy. I mean, he's downright angry. And then he does this absurd thing, right? He says to whoever these people are in charge of the furnace, heat it up 7 times hotter. And, you know, I'm trying to imagine this, like these guys going, I don't know. I guess we can throw some more wood on it. I don't know if they had one of those COVID temperature taking things, but eventually they're like, this guy's a madman. Let's just tell him it's 7 times hotter. So they pile more wood on, they get it nice and hot. And you know the story. Surely you do. Nebuchadnezzar, he won't stand for someone not paying allegiance to his flag, his national anthem, his symbol of the state. So he orders the three exiles thrown into the fiery furnace. But of course, in the fiery furnace, the only thing that gets burned up is the bonds that are holding them in custody. The only thing the fire consumes is the chains holding them in custody. And in that moment, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're more free than they ever have been since they set foot in Babylon. And more than that, the story goes this way. The three exiles are not in the fire alone because there's a fourth person standing in the fire with them. And who is that? We know who that is. It's Jesus. It's what my friend Riley calls time traveling Jesus. He's standing with them in the fire and he's vindicating their convictions. He's vindicating their stance. He's testifying on their behalf, standing in solidarity with the ones who refuse to bow the knee to any idol, any nationalism, any symbol that stands for something outside of Christ's way. And Jesus, the one who is the Word made flesh, which we will celebrate on Christmas Day, before the Word is made flesh, he's standing there in the fire with him and saying, no, we refuse to give our allegiance to flags and symbols and ideologies of this world. Jesus stands when we do that with us in the fires of the consequences of our actions. Let's talk about our position today, because what does it mean to live in exile today? The Christian path, you know, it sort of insists that we're first and foremost, we're citizens of a different country, a different kingdom, a different way of life. And so the idea is while we're in Canada here, we're still exiles in Canada because we're citizens first of heaven. So let's try to thread the needle here. What does it mean to live in Canada at this moment? What does it mean when we think about things like civil disobedience? I mean, consider what's just happening just this weekend. I'm not sure if you know about it, but there's a number of churches that are not happy about government lockdowns again and government restrictions on gathering sizes for churches and places of worship. And it is a constitutional right in Canada for faith groups to be able to meet in person. And so they're sort of using that as, hey, it's our constitutional right. We will not abide by lockdown guidelines or restrictions. And so tomorrow, by the time you see this to yesterday, there's going to be a protest in Toronto, and churches, mosques, synagogues, some of them have come together and they're going to perform this act of civil disobedience and say, we will not abide by government lockdown guidelines. And I got an email, right, this week, like, will you join us? I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, this stuff is just so nonsensical to me, particularly when you think about Jeremiah's words to the exiles. The first principle of living in exile is what? To seek the health, the prosperity, the welfare of the province, the city, the state that you're in. And if that's sort of key area number one, it boggles my mind how any faith group right now can be bothered by and protesting the restrictions. I mean, our COVID cases are skyrocketing, and to sort of flout and ignore that just seems absolutely asinine to me and nonsensical and reckless. And I don't know if you're catching wind of any of this, but I want to be clear where I am. If our responsibility as exiles is for the betterment, the health, prosperity of those around us, the province, the country that we live in, it seems to me it's an easy decision. We wear our masks, we abide by the guidelines, and when we go to code red or lockdown, we come back online. And, you know, I've heard some people say, oh, the churches had to close in this. We have not missed one Sunday. We have not been closed at all since the pandemic began. Church has not been closed. We just haven't been able to meet together. And so stuff like this is nonsense. It infuriates me. This is about the betterment of our neighbors and those around us. And so we wear masks, we follow guidelines. And as of today, this Sunday, we move online when we're told to. How might this play out in other situations? I mean, I've already hinted at it, but what about things like national anthems? And I'll be honest, I don't want to be the first person to try something like this out, but I think there is a good case for refusing to stand for our national anthem. Like Babylon, we have to reckon with the fact that Canada was founded on greed, stolen land, violence, brutality, and cultural genocide. That's just a part of our history. We do not owe allegiance to this country. And for those who find that idea uncomfortable, I want to ask you why. Why do you find that uncomfortable? Why exactly would it be wrong to not stand for our national anthem? I mean, it's not like these problems are just ancient history. Canada is one of the wealthiest and most water-rich countries in the world, and yet still in 2020, at least 61 Indigenous reserves are still under long-term drinking water advisories. These problems haven't gone away. Or consider the 1492 land back protests that have played out here in Kitchener, in Waterloo, but we're getting a lot of attention around what's happening in Caledonia. And what is happening with the land back movement, it's no isolated incident. It's merely a symptom of our nation's refusal to recognize our history and a failure to address it. And this issue is playing out from coast to coast, from Indigenous land defenders in the West Coast to the waters off Nova Scotia, where the Mi'kmaq fishers face intimidation and outright violence for exercising their rights to earn a living off of lobster fishing. These are still problems. They point back to a country that was founded in dubious ways, stolen land, cultural genocide. And I know some of us will be thinking, you know, Brad, don't you respect our country? The reality is this, we do not owe allegiance to this country. And some might say, Brad, are you telling me you're not grateful to live in Canada? Of course I am. You have no idea how grateful I am to live in this country. But there's this interesting idea in scripture, and it's this. Every superpower or empire ends up getting the nickname Babylon. You see, even in the New Testament, when Rome was the superpower of the day, Rome was the one that owned the world, the people who traveled the Christian path, they referred to it as Babylon. And that's because every empire is seen as Babylon. And so I would say this about Canada. I believe Canada is, bar none, the greatest Babylon in the history of the world. There is no greater Babylon that has ever existed than the Babylon of Canada, but it's still Babylon. In scripture, there is no call to love our country. As followers of Jesus, we're not commanded to love our nation. And again, please don't hear me wrong. I'm incredibly grateful to find myself in the best Babylon the world has ever known. You know, I think particular about universal healthcare. Huxley fell out of a tree a couple of weeks ago, right? We thought his ribs were broken, and go to the walk-in clinic, and we're in and out in an hour, and there's no bill to pay. I mean, I can't tell you how grateful I am for a system like that, but the reality is we're not commanded to love our country. We are commanded to love God with all our heart and to love our neighbors as ourselves. Nation is not a proper category of love. And Jesus explains who our neighbor is in the parable of the Good Samaritan. The neighbor and the one that we are called to love is the person that I have the opportunity to help, love, and alleviate their suffering. And to say it pointedly, the biblical case for love of God is love of neighbor. And the test case for love of neighbor is love of enemy. And for those of us who follow the Christian path, national citizenship is accidental. Our true citizenship, Paul reminds us, is of a different kingdom, a different way. And so the exile standard we find in scripture is this: work for the welfare and peace of your country. Do what you can to make it better. Do what you can to make it more prosperous for everyone. But there's no command to love our country. There's no command to give our allegiance to it. Our call is to love God and love neighbors. And again, I'm grateful to live in Canada, Babylon. It's a tremendous country in so many ways, but it doesn't deserve our allegiance. And when nationalism becomes a thing, like Brian Zahn says, we need to call it for what it is. It's an idol. Our task is to love God, love neighbors. And so for me, I try to love God. I try to love my friends and family. I try to love this church. I also seek, when I can, to love my neighbor, especially those near me, anyone close in proximity who I can alleviate their suffering. I mean, I don't do that perfectly. I try to love those close to me that I would consider enemies in some way. But when it comes to my country, I want its welfare. I want its prosperity, and I want its peace, and I'll do everything for that. I'll wear my mask. I'll do the social distancing. We meet online. But that, for me, has to be enough. It is enough. And so, friends, I hope you'll join us on our Zoom discussion, because I'm just throwing out some ideas here and would love to chat about it with you afterwards. But our first life in exile Advent story comes from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who work for the welfare but simply cannot cross certain convictions. And when they pay the price for those standards and convictions, who is standing with them but Jesus? Friends, as we head towards Christmas season, I hope we will remember those things and take them to heart this season.